All right, in just a few moments, Dr. Frank Albo joins me here on Coast. He's been referred to as Canada's Dan Brown of the Da Vinci Code fame for his architectural detective work. His new book is a beautiful pictorial, a presentation of this shiny New Age capital in the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. You can, and some see Astana, this capital city, as the Illuminati's world capital. The president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, was recently elected to something like his fifth term, I believe, I think he's been president since 1991, the only president the independent republic has ever had. He was recently reelected with something like a 97.7% approval rating, or the popular vote, which tells you about the state of democracy, I guess, in Kazakhstan. But the oil-rich country has been described as a kleptocracy ruled by an autocrat, while Nazarbayev's defenders claim the country is working on sorting out the country's economic development first, and then they'll work on the economy, or on the democracy. Clearly, much of the country's oil and gas wealth has been poured into Nazarbayev's shiny city. And again, quoting from The Guardian, for a centrally planned city, the aesthetic juxtapositions are remarkably discordant. A flashy glass pyramid, a towering set of apartments built to match Moscow University in the Stalinist Empire style, a Disney version of the White House, a vase-like tower with a ball on top that the president apparently designed on the back of a napkin during a state dinner, a finance ministry shaped as a dollar bill. Few of these buildings seem to have been designed with practicality in mind. Well, we'll get a guided tour of Astana when Dr. Frank Albo stops by next, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Frank Albo is an architectural historian and an expert on communicating new streams of knowledge in relation to the built environment and the cultures of the past. He holds graduate degrees in ancient Near Eastern languages, Western esotericism, and the history of art, receiving his PhD from the University of Cambridge in 2012. Dr. Albo's approach to architecture, landscape, and design seeks to transform public spaces into interactive journeys of discovery, which elevate the mind and promote a sense of wonder and inspiration. He was featured as the code-breaking protagonist in the best-selling book, The Hermetic Code, now in its fourth printing, and has lectured internationally on a broad range of subjects, from the cosmology of Egyptian temples to the minimalism of modern architecture. His groundbreaking discoveries on the meanings encoded in public monuments, gardens, and cities have been published in numerous peer-reviewed journals, as well as in several radio, television, and documentary programs. Dr. Frank Albo's new book, it's a good one, Astana, Architecture, Myth, and Destiny. Frank Albo, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm delightful. Thank you for having me on, Richard.
My pleasure. How do you feel about being compared to Dan Brown? You've been called the Dan Brown of Canada, he of the Da Vinci Code.
Well, it was a tongue-in-cheek description that was given to me by the former premier of Manitoba, and for whatever reason, it stuck. I take no real umbrage in it, other than the Dan Brown is obviously writing works of fiction, and I am not.
Well, just take us back to the Hermetic Code for a moment, and many Coast listeners may not be familiar with the Manitoba. Winnipeg is the capital of Manitoba, the provincial capital, and you studied the symbolism embedded or encoded in the design of the provincial legislature. This is the capital building, I suppose, provincially. Talk to me about that. What did you find?
Well, I stumbled upon a unique feature on the roof of the building that caused me to descend down a rabbit hole of discovery and enchantment that is left by the architect. And there were two recumbent Egyptian sphinxes on the roof. And one day, driving by a familiar building, I noticed these sphinxes there and literally just parked my car, looked up, and tried to answer the riddle of the sphinx. I couldn't think of a more a mythological inspiration to any quest, and that sent me down this discovery. So what resulted in that was I took on several graduate degrees trying to get into the mind of the dead British genius who decided to build a Masonic reconstruction of King Solomon's temple right in the geographical center of North America. So the building is loaded with fascinating descriptions. It's tantamount to a vocabulary of thousands of years of architectural knowledge hidden in plain view. There are hidden hieroglyphic inscriptions. The number 666 and 13 repeats throughout the building. And it was designed to basically initiate the public, and in particular the government, into this exotic vision of the architect's mind. He believed that the building could act as a moralizing device. So it's predicated on numerology, mysticism, Masonic ideas of architecture, but ultimately it was designed to reflect the most important of all buildings venerated in the ancient world, King Solomon's Temple.
And Frank Worthington Simon, who designed it, was he not sort of the architect to the royal family in Britain?
Well, he was he worked on several projects in Great Britain. One was Balmoral Castle, but his chief approach to architecture was as a student. He studied the Bible very carefully. His father was a nonconformist theologian, very famous in the British Empire. And at a very young age, he was reared in a scholarly study of texts and buildings. So he became a professor of architecture, and he believed that architecture, among all disciplines known to the human mind, had the capacity to reform the soul. And with that penchant for architecture, he joined a secret society, Freemasonry, which draws upon those same motifs that architecture can ameliorate man.
Wasn't it his sort of outlandish idea that the what they call the MLAs, the members of the Legislative Assembly, would actually gather in Greek togas or something like that?
Yeah, well, he was an idealist and a romantic in the sense of his veneration of the ancient world. So he was part of a lost tradition of architecture, that there was a language in architecture and that there was a golden age that had been destroyed from the fall of the Roman Empire, and he was trying to reconstruct it in the form of an edifice that masqueraded as a house of government but was really designed as this virtuizing civic building, that just by walking through it and the subliminal messages encoded inside, that it would have an impact on you, that it would reform your soul. That was the idea.
And the figure atop the Manitoba legislature, Hermes, and that's where you get the name of the book, The Hermetic Code. Exactly. Explain who the Greek god Hermes was and why that's significant.
Well, Hermes is the patron of Freemasonry, and the oldest lore of Freemasonry, the old charges, it's Hermes that deposits these fundamental secrets that become the basis of Masonic architecture, the notion of numerology, the power of geometry in particular. These were ideas that were attributed to Hermes, and in particular, Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice greatest one. And throughout the Middle Ages, and including the Renaissance, Hermes was no mere pagan messenger of the gods, but a contemporary of Moses, a prophet of the Christian revelation. And if you've ever been to Siena Cathedral, right at the front of the nave of the cathedral, there is this glorious image, mosaic, of Hermes Trismegistus there before Abraham, Moses, or all of the other patriarchs there announcing the Christian message. So Hermes was seen as this embodiment of divine knowledge and the notion of what the Greeks called gnosis, inner knowledge.
Now, there's a story I remember reading about you, and didn't the then premier, I'm not sure if it was Gary Doer, premier of the province, sort of he found out what you were up to, or wanted to find out what you were up to, and he called you into his office, and what happened there?
Well, yeah, I wrote my undergraduate thesis on two rooms in the building, and for whatever reason, it just circulated throughout the halls of government. And what was shocking to me is about 8 months later, after having submitted my thesis and I was on to another university, I was called into his office, and it was a strange moment because there he was flipping through my thesis, because for some reason it moved, like some I don't know, occult manifesto within the the corridors of power. And he was intrigued enough to call me in, and he said, well, what do you think of this building? And I said, well, the White House has nothing on this building. And he said, well, what do you need? And I said, well, three things. I need to be in this building at all times of day. I need to have access to all government documents related to the building's construction. And I need to go to all parts of the building. And he gave me this carte blanche access to do so, and a provincial grant, which allowed me to spend 3 years, well, 2 years, studying literally every facet of the building.
Fascinating. Now let's move on to Astana, Architecture, Myth, and Destiny, the new book. I don't think I'm alone in saying this. You know, prior to looking at this book and doing a little research, I'd never heard of Astana. And I'm guessing a lot of people don't even know where, they couldn't find Kazakhstan on a map. How is it that you've dedicated so much time and effort and putting this beautiful book together on Astana? How did you discover Astana?
Well, it's perhaps the most remarkable capital ever constructed or conceived, for a number of reasons I hope we can explore. It's the most recently planned capital, and the strange alien architecture of the capital just beckons further attention. So it's, as you mentioned in the prologue, it has a glistening glass pyramid, a giant UFO, many other oddities of architecture. And to me, the general consensus of the buildings or the interpretations of them were very superficial, and I felt there was something much more deeper brewing on here. It's a post-Soviet capital. It makes, it looks like Las Vegas on steroids, but there's a mythic impulse behind this city, why it's being constructed, and I decided to explore it very deeply.
So you take umbrage, obviously, with the notion that Astana is the world headquarters for the Illuminati.
Well, yes. Let's get the cat out of the bag right there. Astana is not the Illuminati capital of the world. The Illuminati, it instead, had a very short-lived existence, about 12 years, from 1776 to 1788, and has been hyper-mythologized ever since. We could go into that perhaps later. But because of the architectural features in the capital, it has only led to the same ominous conclusion. Surely the hand of the Illuminati has designed this building. I mean, it has emerged out of Soviet Russia. It was the least likely to succeed. It had a 20th century of nothing but hardship and turmoil, and yet out of nowhere, with this this capital almost like rising up like a phoenix out of the ashes, is becoming the Geneva of Central Asia. And so for me, it was kind of like the Sphinx all over again. I saw something there, and my academic sensibilities, a hunch, kind of brewed, and I thought, this is worthy of further exploration. And I had no idea that it was going to lead to the book that is now, I think, widely circulated.
So why did what motivated Nazarbayev, I think we have to call him an autocrat, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
Why did he, I mean, because this wasn't Kazakhstan's capital. I mean, they moved it, right? And he built this from the ground up. What was the motivation?
Okay, well, first of all, he knew that in order to dislocate with the former Soviet capital, which was Almaty, in order to forge this new national identity, it needed to begin with a new capital. And this has been going on for thousands of years, from Constantinople to Akhenaten to the moving of the capital to Washington, D.C. There's always been this place for the capital city to be a tabula rasa, birthed from scratch. So by this effort of reestablishing the identity of Kazakhstan, largely associated in the minds of many as the homeland of Borat, he wanted to create this capital that would reflect national ideas, but also be a billboard to interfaith harmony and global ecology and all of these 21st century tropes that invited people to open their eyes to it. It beckons you to want to explore this city. As a historian of architecture, I've never seen anything on this scale or this kind of megalomania.
Well, that's the key term there, I think, is megalomania. Was it not at one time considered that they were going to actually name it Nazbayarev after the leader?
Oh, yeah, very much so. In fact, they still may change the name. I'm glad they haven't. There's an element to my book, which is this treasure hunt, that it's important that they kept the name as it is.
And what is Astana? What does that mean?
It means capital.
All right.
It's
so
simply that.
Above and beyond, you know, the megalomaniac's desire to build, you know, these edifices to, I suppose, you know, in homage to himself, what is at work here? And perhaps maybe we could start it from this angle. Why do the suspicious minded think that this might be sort of, let's park the term Illuminati, but let's say, you know, sort of a New World Order type. One world government, one world religion, these sorts of things sort of, you know, cause certain mindsets to get a little antsy. So why do they think that?
Well, let's talk about the one world religion. I think that's a really important element to this. There is one of the most significant iconic buildings in the capital is called the Pyramid of Peace and Reconciliation. And every 3 years, in fact, meeting this year, the world religious leaders from around the world meet at the apex of this giant glass pyramid to discuss religious harmony and the ecology of faiths. And this was very much in the a part of ancient Kazakh identity. And to understand this, you need to go back to the origins of the Silk Road. Kazakhstan is uniquely situated, perhaps one of the most strategically important countries in the world, in that it is sandwiched between both the East and the West. It is not East and it's not West. And it has acted as a kind of potpourri, a cross-fertilization of cultural and religious ideas from Buddhism, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, one of the oldest faiths, such as Tengrianism. And these ideas percolated in this nomadic culture for thousands of years. And because of this, nomads are trenchantly open and adaptable, pluralistic to religious ideas. And for Nazarbayev and for Kazakh people in general, they adopt religion in the same sense that we might attend a smorgasbord. You have a little bit of each, and that becomes part of your identity. And this seems to be the vision of choice of modern society. If you aren't, if you're going to be religiously minded, it seems that we're living more in an age of either stark extremism or adaptable to other faiths. So this building is meant to be this beacon of welcoming other religious beliefs. So with that in mind, you see a pyramid, you see religious leaders meeting at the apex, and obviously, from the first impulse, the knee-jerk reaction is to say, a controlling world totalitarian government. And that, I must assure you, is the most simple reading of the text.
But isn't that suspicion engendered by the fact that you have this autocrat running the country? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Is it possible there may be something more sinister afoot here?
Well, here's the thing. I specifically wrote this book with three basic ideals in mind. I set out to write a rigorous, scholarly, historical study of the most strangest capital city in the world. And so at one level of reading, I'd hope you had a chance to peruse it yourself, you'll read a scholarly study of a city. On another level, I look at the city through a semiotic reading. It's a branch of anthropology in which we look at signs and symbols and their interpretation. And
Frank, if I could, pardon the interruption, I'm going to get you to finish that thought on the other side. We're up against a break here, forgive me. Guess Who, taking us into the break. Share the Land, back with more on Astana, Architecture, Myth, and Destiny with Dr. Frank Albo, right here on Coast to Coast. Tears for fears. Everybody wants to rule the world. Well, does Nazarbayev want to rule the world, the autocrat who's ruling the former Soviet republic of Kazakhstan? No, not necessarily so, says Frank Elbow. He may just be trying to build this utopia which springs out of this barren steppe land in the former Soviet republic of Kazakhstan. We'll get back to that conversation and take a kind of a tour, take you on a tour of Astana, this remarkable, shiny, gleaming capital in Kazakhstan. We'll do that in just a few moments. Now, I want to tell you about George Norrie and his doings. He's coming to Scottsdale, Arizona. They're calling it the Scottsdale Invasion. That's happening Saturday, April the 21st, at the Virginia G. Piper Theater, 5 to 8 p.m. You can enjoy watching George interview spirit traveler Sonia Grace, astronomer and master of all things space, Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. And then he'll end the evening with a UFO roundtable featuring some of the most respected people in ufology, including Dr. Lynn Katai from the Phoenix Lights, of course, Melinda Leslie, Travis Walton, John D'Souza. And then George will sing a few songs. He's got a live band in tow. You can take part in a Q&A with each guest. So you don't want to miss out on this. Again, that's Saturday, April the 21st in Phoenix, or rather in Scottsdale, at the Virginia G. Piper Theater. And you can call the box office at 480-499-8587 or visit scottsdaleperformingarts.org. All right, back with more of my conversation with Dr. Frank Elbow, Astana, Architecture, Myth, and Destiny, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Frank Elbow is with us, Astana, Architecture, Myth, and Destiny. And Frank, apologies, I interrupted you. You were sort of outlining the three main reasons that you wrote this book. And you know, I don't want to mischaracterize it. It is not just a book full of beautiful photographs. It is just dense with incredible information, and later we'll tell people about the contest, a remarkable, intriguing contest that you have running as well. But let's continue with, we were on reason two, why you wrote the book. If you want to recap reason one, please do so.
Okay, so just in terms of my methodology, on one level, it's a scholarly study of a strange alien capital. On another, it uses semiotics, which is a form of studying signs and symbols and looking for their meaningful interpretations. Yet a third, and yet this is the heart of the book, is that hidden, embedded deep within the buildings and the environment of Astana is a collective myth. And this is, it's important to unpack this, because as I describe in the book, myth has been given a bum rap. It's seen as being synonymous with fiction. And myth is one of the most important glues to civic identity, world society, and that goes back at the birth of civilization. And what is unique about Astana is that the buildings themselves form signatures of a collective foundation myth. It reflects one of the oldest myths in world history, which is the Sumerian tale of Etana. Are you familiar with this work?
I'm not, no.
Okay, so the Sumerian tale of Etana is one of the oldest myths in world history, and it recounts the study or the construction of a great city, a monumental tower, and in this tower is a tree of life. And out of this tree of life, an eagle births its egg, representing the sun, and every year, a malevolent serpent steals the sun, and one day, a child hero saves the egg, the sun, and the eagle rescues the child and takes him up to heaven. This is one of the oldest myths in history. It's called the Sumerian tale of Etana. Now, as far as I know, no other city in the world has decided to build this myth as the central monument in the capital. And that's what's known as the Baipyrik Tower in the center of Astana. All the buildings around Astana revolve around this beacon called the Tree of Life. Now, when we think of the Tree of Life, you immediately make an association, if you're a Judeo-Christian persuasion, of the Tree of Life in the Garden of Eden. Now, this story goes back to our oldest collective stories. There are about 300 variations of this particular story, the Sumerian Tale of Etana, and never has it been built as an architectural device, as a showpiece that is meant to kind of signal the rise of a new nation. And what's neat about this tale is that it is reflected over and over again in the buildings and the monuments. This is why almost all the basic infrastructure of the Capitol, from the east-west alignment of the entire mall, the emblems that appear on the peak of most of the buildings, is the eagle. And so it's this element of eagle, child, and that is part of one of the architectural features of the Capitol, this eagle and child narrative.
Right. And I have to admit, Baderach, it's a beautiful building. It's quite stunning. And I'm not a huge fan of modern architecture. I'm kind of an Art Deco guy, but this is very pleasing to the eye. Now, tell me about the two golden towers. They've been described as the beer cans. The beer cans, which isn't very kind. But,
or the beer cans, right.
Yeah.
Well, it depends how you look at it. This is the House of Ministries. So one of the city visions of the Capitol is often with the Baiteric Tower in the center, which I just described, and on either side of them are these two gleaming golden towers. They're otherwise known as the House of Ministries, but they reflect the most important emblems in the symbolism of Freemasonry. They're known as the twin pillars that stood in front of the porchway of King Solomon's temple. And these two towers can be found over and over again in the canon of Western architectural historiography. Here, they take on a decidedly different reading. And so if you look at the Capitol as a lens, you read the buildings, you read the Capitol as a way that we would read books, it tells very deep things about our collective heritage going back thousands of years, and also presents a vision for the future.
All right. Now, the presidential palace, the Ak Orda presidential palace, which I guess is the workplace of the president, and it looks very similar to the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, with the dome and the, I don't know if those are, what kind of columns those are, those Corinthian columns, or, well, you'll tell me, but tell me about this structure.
Okay, yeah, it's a mere knockoff, except much larger, of the White House, but it also has other things that are uniquely different. It it carries the blue dome, and one of the features of the Capitol is that blue is prescribed to be blue or gold are the facades of most of the buildings in Astana, meant to reflect the eternal blue sky and the gold of the sun. And so the Accorda Palace is the presidential palace. It's monolithic, that's for sure. But yes, you would see the kind of stamp of Washington, D.C., but there are other elements behind the Platonic shapes inside of the Accorda, which have a different reading.
All right. And then we have the Kazakhstan Parliament building. And this is well, it's kind of a pastiche, really, as far as I can tell, of different types of architecture. There's some, looks like some, a little bit of Middle Eastern influence. There's a little bit of Art Deco in there. What's going on here?
Well, yeah. See, this is one of the elements that is so present in the capital of Astana, and that is this uniquely identifiable style, which you nailed, which is this pastiche of a blend of postmodernism, Central Asian art, kind of Islamic decoration, or a lot of Russian Baroque, by the way. And these ideas are meant to show that Astana is open to the traditions and cultures of the world and blended in a rather bizarre way. But again, that is just a superficial reading.
Now, the idea that, you know, that old saying from Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this, the summoning of almost like a you know, an ecumenical council of world religious leaders. Are they sort of buying in? Are they coming to Astana and participating?
Yes. So this year is, I believe, the fourth or fifth World Council of Traditional Religions. It has grown. I think there are 80 participants and or 80 different religious denominations, but the idea being that yes, build it and they will come is certainly one of the monikers that you can attract to the capital. The idea that we build our buildings, you might be familiar with this Churchillian phrase, we build our buildings and then our buildings build us. Well, that was the idea with the capital, is that they decided from a blank slate in less than 20 years, all of the buildings that you see there were constructed in less than 20 years. They had a billion-dollar budget almost every year in the first order of the capital. And rather than putting it into some things that other members of the Kazakhstani public and Kazakhstani citizens said, why have we spent all this money on brash architecture? The idea is to use architecture as a way of building a new image of the state. And the state has emerged from like the rubble of the Soviet Union to become a progressively more important world leader. And I think architecture is one of the lightning rods to this effect.
Yeah, I had mentioned off the top that I think this was like the last Soviet republic to declare independence after the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1991. It was the home of you know, the gulags.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how bad is the radiation there too? Because they did a lot of their nuclear testing there, and that's a problem, obviously. But is radiation is a concern there?
Well, you've actually brought me back home to a subject I wanted to bring earlier, is the buildings in the Capitol reflect what I believe to be a solution to the three greatest threats of our time, religious extremism, the sustainability of the planet, and nuclear proliferation. Kazakhstan is unique in that it was a nuclear test site for the Soviet Union for almost 40 years. And in some areas of Kazakhstan, the radiation and inflicted illness on children is still being experienced today. There were nearly 600 secret nuclear tests that detonated there near Astana, very near the location of Astana, was one of the most fierce and awful and wretched of all of Stalin's gulags, which was for the betrayers, the wives of the betrayers of the homeland. So on the soil of Kazakhstan, especially for the 20th century, it has been ominously bad. Also, it was in terms of environmental pollution, the drying up of the Aral Sea, which was one of the projects that was used to irrigate. Kazakhstan was designated the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, and they diverted all this water from the Aral Sea to farmlands that were occupied by, for thousands of years, nomads, and it was just a total disaster. So this is a country that has experienced the tyranny of 300 years of the Soviet Union. They have experienced nuclear wasteland and detonations. They've experienced gulags and also one of the worst environmental disasters. And out of this environment, they're deciding to build a capital that is meant to illustrate exactly the opposite of all of these. Not a tyrannical government, but a open faith policy to world religions. The world expo that opened last year was dedicated to the sustainability of the planet. And Kazakhstan is probably the most aggressive world leader, aggressive is the right term, for non-nuclear proliferation. So Kazakhstan really leads that charge because on its own accord, they recognize that nuclear weapons in the wrong hands has catastrophic effects. And so the city itself is meant to reflect these ideas over and over again: religious tolerance, planetary sustainability, and non-nuclear proliferation. Buildings are designed and dedicated to these values.
I believe that Kazakhstan was one of the first former Soviet republics. I mean, they could have been a nuclear power. They had nuclear missiles, but they gave them up, correct?
Right. So they inherited the fourth largest stockpile of nuclear material, and they did something nobody ever expected. The Americans were going there saying, what are you going to do? Please tell me you're not going to sell this to rogue nations. As I mentioned, of the 15 post-Soviet republics, Kazakhstan was the least likely to succeed. So in the chart of 1 to 15, it was the least likely to succeed. Their only great value, at least in the eyes of Western leaders, was the stockpile of nuclear material. And what they did, which was quite shocking to us today, is they completely disarmed it. They just disarmed all of the nuclear weapons and created a new model of peace-bearing non-nuclear society.
All right. Now, that brings us to the Palace of Peace and Reconciliation. You mentioned it looks a little bit like the part of the City Hall here at Nathan Phillips Square, just a stone's throw from where I'm sitting in Toronto. But this is it supposed to be a UFO?
Oh, no. The UFO is the a circus. The Palace
of Peace. Yes, I'm looking at the wrong description. My apologies. You're right. The Metropolitan Circus. Okay. So, is that supposed to be a UFO?
Yes, it is exactly a UFO. Kazakh culture and lore and folklore draws a great deal from associations with the stars. Most people don't know this, but the Baikonur is the oldest fully operational space station, which is still operating in Kazakhstan. And so there is this, a lot of Kazakh culture is dedicated towards looking at the stars and a close affinity to them.
So what do we know about Nazarbayev? Is he really the brains behind this, or did he sort of hire a team of architects and they were sort of left to their own devices? Or is this his master plan, truly his?
Well, it's his, most certainly his brainchild. He knew that architecture was, well, two things could crystallize the value of his nation in his mind. One was architecture and the other was folklore. And he brought both of them together on a grand scale in Astana. And for at the early period that he set out to move the capital, it was seen as just a vision of a kind of fool's errand. And he was highly criticized for it. And what he set out to do was he called upon the I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but it's a starchitect. It's a star architect. Think of the Brad Pitt of architecture.
Right.
Like if you think of, if I say Sydney, you immediately think of the Opera House. If I say Paris, you think the Eiffel Tower. And so there are these iconic buildings that were built by architects that have this power, like the Guggenheim, for instance. And so he selected from this vaunted class, this pantheon of global architects, to build massive projects in the capital. So for an architect salivating to work on projects like this, he sort of developed his own brand of architecture. There were certain basic things that he wanted included, but at the same time, he appealed to the professionalism of that class. The master plan itself was designed by a Japanese architect named Kisha Kurokawa, and Kisha Kurokawa did something really neat in the capital. He blended the idea of biological growth into the capital. It's a very, very sophisticatedly designed city. It's designed only to grow to 3 million people. There's an entire bedrock. The perimeter of the city is surrounded by trees that bring fresh air. It is very flexible in its design. It blends old and new, unlike Brasilia, which is a planned capital but is entirely new and dislocated from the traditional past of Brazil.
You almost make me want to visit. Maybe I will. Listen, we got to take a time out, Frank. Thank you for your patience. Flogging Molly, if ever I leave this world alive, taking us into the break, and then back with more of my conversation with Frank Albo, Astana, Architecture, Myth, and Destiny, right here on Coast to Coast.